Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein, here for another conversation. Today we have in our studio David Oakley, who's a criminal trial attorney who lives in Princeton, New Jersey, and is a fellow at the Center for Thomas More Studies at the University of Dallas. He has a new book out with his co-author entitled Inside the Mind of Thomas More, The Witness of His Writings. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Good, good. Well, let's begin with the first fact that you note in your book, which we'll link to on the website, that in 2000, John Paul II proclaimed to the world that Thomas More is the patron of statesmen, politicians, and lawyers. Do we really want to have the great Thomas More associated with politicians and lawyers? Is it the patron saint of connivers and deceivers? Anyway.
That's a serious question, though. I think it's a serious question. And Thomas More is an interesting figure in that he was certainly not blind to the, let's say, the perils which attended, personal, moral, and social perils which attended public service. So it's not a bad question, actually. His answer was that it is worthwhile. He is really a continuator of the tradition of antiquity, you know, most prominently represented in Cicero. But even as the most prominent representative, perhaps in the early modernity of that tradition, at least in the Northern Renaissance, he also failed, you know, because his manner of engagement, did not lead to real reform or success, but actually issued in his execution.
Right, right.
So it's not a bad question, you know, right, whether or not we should be encouraging patrons.
All right. Well, you say a couple of pages later that what he really stands for, what he goes down in worldly history as representing is, quote, principled resistance to state authority. He is, in some ways, he's a martyr, not just a martyr to the faith, but he's a martyr to conscience against the power of the state.
Right. And this is the sort of the timeless value of Thomas More. And it's certainly what Pope now, Pope Saint or Saint Pope, Saint Pope John Paul II, identified More's importance as the one who stood up to power and asserts with the price of his own life the primacy of truth over power. And though that's a fascinating, you know, sort of statement even today, where truth, of course, is under assault. I should say that, you know, with the, let's say, the diminishment of truth, or the sort of a fading away of truth, kind of power becomes all the more significant. I think that's a kind of a commonplace. I've read it millions of times, I think, in many First Things issues, right? And so those people who retain an understanding that there is truth, and when that truth comes in conflict with the law, More is a reminder that truth doesn't yield. And we may even have to pay very, very high prices for adherence to the truth. And More paid the highest price, and that's why he is still relevant.
You know, you make a distinction on the issue of truth in the book when you talk about conscience as maintaining really not just to thine own self be true, mm-hmm. To quote Polonius, but that conscience always has to make an appeal to truth. If you can't say my conscience has some relationship to some outside reality and my adherence to it is the truth, simply saying I can't go along with this, my conscience tells me not to, we sometimes forget in our, you know, postmodern individualistic age the ground of the proper ground of conscience beyond ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to put in the forefront. And we tried to do that by starting this little book with a discussion of More's concept of conscience, I couldn't agree more enthusiastically with you, because it's clear that if one is to make these gigantic sacrifices, they're only sensible if the sacrifice is made to something which is greater than oneself. And that kind of proposition, that there should be these sort of transcendental truths that are greater than oneself, is of course not enjoying a heyday in our own times. But for those people who are of faith and people of goodwill, they still will find that they are subject to real truth, that they're part of a greater order to which they can, have to adhere. And to the extent that our rulers want to compel behavior or thought, even more frighteningly, contrary to these truths, we're going to have to pay a price. And so, this notion of the primacy of truth is foundational to understanding more. And I think I'll just make as an aside that the Bolt play is a fascinating play. It's really, in many ways, the inspiration for this little book. But the Bolt himself, in his introduction, and in some of the lines that he gave Moore, shows that Bolt himself did not think that there was this kind of objective truth. He was a man of his time, that he was, I guess you'd call him some kind of Bergsonian existentialist, radical individualist, and believed that it was, important for people just to stand up for their own beliefs, and that was warrant enough.
You're talking about the play and the movie, A Man for All Seasons.
Absolutely, yes. Robert Bolt's play and movie. Right,
right, right. Which still is a powerful film.
Oh, absolutely, and it should be viewed. And it seems to me that it's a great starting point, a great popular starting point for appreciation of Thomas More. And it was for me, and it was for my college buddy with whom I wrote this.
Paul Scofield won the Academy.
Academy Award, 1969.
1969.
Yeah,
indeed. I'm not sure the Academy would appreciate that kind of performance today. But we've got a different version, popular version of Moore on the screen with the more recent Hilary Mantel.
Right. Well, I guess it was put up in, there's a television series as well as a Broadway play. I don't know how long it ran for, but certainly the book, the formidable book, Wolf Hall, attempted to portray a different Thomas More and a different Thomas Cromwell as well,
Cromwell being his lead interrogator.
Yes.
Right.
But Cromwell being more than just his lead interrogator, Cromwell really was, let's say, like kind of a high-ranking factotum of Henry VIII, who was trying to see reform of Henry carried through. And it's most historians, well, I guess the most famous, kind of one of the most famous historians of the Reformation, J.A. or John Guy, he has a certain amount of respect for Cromwell. He recognizes that the guy is a rank pragmatist, but at the same time, he tried to bring his reforms through Parliament, kind of a popular will.
And while Moore was beheaded, mm-hmm. What happened to Cromwell?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think I mentioned that in the book.
You do.
Is that Moore? I think this is part of the great merit of Thomas Moore is that he was despite the precariousness of his situation, he still gave advice. He gave advice to Henry. He gave advice to Cromwell, even though it probably wasn't welcome, but he was trying to take care of that obligation that he felt to, in the case of Cromwell, to a colleague, a co-equal, and in the case of Henry, to his sovereign. And after his arrest, Moore told Cromwell that he told him, "I'll give you some advice. I mean, if you were told a lion what he could do, you could scarcely control him. So you shouldn't tell the king what he can do, but what he ought to do." Very interesting. And I just speculate, of course, it's a kind of a throwaway line, but I think it has some significance that Cromwell probably didn't follow that advice because he himself was arrested and executed for treason 5 years later.
Right, right.
Poor dude.
How did Moore end up in this difficult position of defying the king?
Well,
why would he? I mean, you say in the book he was making a very good living, a very successful lawyer. He had wonderful property. He had a family, and he decides to step into this hornet's nest of the world close to the king. Why would he do this?
So to answer the question, we could look at a couple of phases. One is his becoming a royal counselor. And he was one of those for 14 years and kind of rose up the ranks and received more and more responsibility and more lucrative positions. Ultimately, though, after 14 years, he became the chancellor, which is the highest judicial and executive position in the realm. So becoming a royal counselor, Moore was probably motivated by a number of motives, as my a great scholar of Thomas More, but probably more famous as a philosopher, Father Joseph Kotursky, says, "I've never met a motive that wasn't mixed." But it was certainly understood that becoming a royal counselor was a way for professional advancement in the 16th century. I mean, there was one seat of power, right, and everything sort of flowed from it. But there was also the fact that Moore had, and this is really a fascinating thing, the way Moore integrates his intellectual, spiritual, and professional lives, that he is a guy who thought very, very deeply about serving a king. And that comes through in any number of writings, but most famously, the writing known to every student, namely Utopia. Because Utopia, really, the half of Utopia, the so-called Book One Dialogue of Council, is really about whether one should serve a king. So before he's even a royal counselor and is just doing some bit work for the crown, namely representing the crown in negotiations with merchants in the Low Countries, Moore's thinking about that. So he's thinking seriously about the obligations to serve in that regard, and to serve the king, but also the dangers that go along with that. When you think about the dangers, and you think back to Moore's early work, which was never published, never completed, rather, and that's the history of Richard III. And in that, it shows the dangers, the incredible dangers which attend royal service.
You say at one point, execution was an occupational hazard.
Yeah, for sure.
being close to the king.
And of course, Moore said it 100 times better in the passage in his history of Richard III, where he says that, well, these are stage plays, and if you don't play these are stage plays carried out on scaffolds, right? And he who does not play his role well finishes badly. And of course, there's a double entendre there, right? Because the scaffold was the place for the play, right? It was also the place of the execution.
Right.
The end was a bad end. It wasn't just being booed, it was also being executed. So motivation then, Moore sees all of these dangers. But I think he was motivated by this kind of classical Ciceronian sense of duty of serving the Commonwealth.
Does he admire Henry VIII as a great king?
Well,
I mean, I'm sure it's mixed, but does part of him recognize Henry VIII is sort of almost a larger-than-life figure?
I think it's difficult to answer that question because, these absolute monarchs, are so, let's say, insulated from any kind of criticism. So Moore really think? That's a difficult, in this day and age, because we find out what people think, too much about, the people they work for.
Right.
I would answer the question this way. Early on, Moore definitely had great hopes for Henry VIII, and we quote the coronation ode, Moore is urging Henry to be this Christian prince, he's also warning him about the dangers of untrammeled power and how it corrupts one's judgment and deadens the will. So he's very concerned about that. So I think he had great hope for Henry VIII. That's clear. He also had a lot of reservations about Henry VII. That's clear from reading Richard III, because that whole story ends with Henry VII. In fact, that's probably why he never completed the history of Richard III, because, any criticism of that denouement was basically a criticism of Henry VII. So mm-hmm. I think at some point he prudently pulled the plug on that work. So early on then, I think he had great hope for Henry VIII being a Christian prince. I think it's very clear, though, that and we know this from his communications with Erasmus, and also to the extent that he would have been one with Erasmus in this aspiration for European-wide peace, that Christian princes could be controlled, checked in their ambitions and their use of force by their faith. And he really thought, I think, that he was a true believer in that, as was Erasmus. Mm-hmm. And so that it was believed that Henry would be able to fall into that. Of course, he did not. He did the exact opposite under Cardinal Wolsey. They basically said, France is ours, and they started to try to get France back. Now, ultimately, that failed, and there's a famous, a field of cloth of gold, but that's the kind of the peace with France, and England gave up that claim. Mm-hmm. Now, that also spelled the end of Wolsey, right? As well as Wolsey's failure to keep the marriage proceeding, the annulment proceeding between Henry and Catherine in England. That opened up the chancellorship for Moore. But I would say that Moore is probably quite disappointed in Wolsey and in Henry's, sort of European aspirations, to control more than England. Mm-hmm. We know from very early on, Moore, before he's a royal counselor, he's translating poetry from Lucian and from others, and about basically political theory and limited government and, very commonplaces perhaps to us now, but at the time, not that well known. Yeah. So the second phase of Moore's relationship with Henry has to do with them becoming the chancellor, right? And to answer your question, well, what was he doing there? We try to deal with that directly in the book, because one of the things I appreciated right away when I just got into the history is that when Moore becomes the chancellor, the situation is the situation about the marriage and is in a dire state. Moore is already told at least on two occasions. To the king that he's not supporting the annulment proceeding, any kind of decree of annulment or a new marriage to somebody else. And so, notwithstanding that fact, Moore becomes chancellor. Now, perhaps he didn't have a chance or an opportunity, a real opportunity to refuse, because maybe it was one of these "I make you an offer, you can't refuse" kind of idea. He is the king, but there's no doubt. And John Guy gives us some significant evidence that Henry was really out to change Moore's mind. Now,
and Moore believed he could.
And he believed he could. And Moore, of course, was the most. He was a prodigy. I mean, he could. He was the most amazing lawyer judge of his time. So he was a great candidate for the job too. But Henry must have wanted him, and Moore, notwithstanding that fact, didn't evade the job. He took it. He filled it for about 4 years. And of course it ended, with his resignation. And during that time he was importuned, of course, by Henry to change his mind, which he did not. And why would he have done that? Well, Again, I guess, you know, I'm sure there are a number of motives. I guess there, you can't discount the possibility of the professional advancement. But even like the most kind of like least hagiographic sort of historian, like a John Guy, will say that Moore was also motivated by the fact that this was an opportunity to advance the interest of Catherine of Aragon in a subtle way. Because, when the marriage question was like being fought and in a dire state for Henry, because Catherine successfully transferred the matter to Rome, then that's where the fight really began, because the Aragon, Catherine Aragon's kind of party, those nobles supporting her, needed to convince the king to abandon this proceeding.
Did he believe that if the king pushes forward in this, it won't just be jeopardy for the king? It really will strike at the heart of the sovereign, of the crown, of England, as well. Were the stakes that high for him?
Yeah, I think everyone appreciated that the stakes were gigantic, and Moore sees hanging in the balance Christendom, the Christian prince. And those things are all in question, in jeopardy, if the dominance of the official church would end.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the reasons that you mentioned why Moore endorses the reading of the pagans. Because what the pagan writers, you mentioned Cicero, what the pagan writers did for him, the ones he was reading at the time, was remind us today, at the present time, of the limitations of worldly power and the dangers of avoiding those limitations. And he sees Henry as a prime case of needing that kind of moral instruction.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Of course, Moore early on talks about the dangers which any ruler has and lives with. And one of them is this lack of counsel, because everyone around you has something to gain. And in fact, when Henry started asking, I say this in the book, we say this, when Henry started asking around about, hey, what do you think about my new marriage plan, or what do you think whether I was really married to Catherine of Aragon, Moore tells him in the first time, says, hey, listen, you know, you're asking the wrong people. I mean, we're totally dependent on you, and so, you know, you can't, we're not reliable counselors in this way, right? Along the same lines, you know, that Moore wanted, and this is just in a footnote that Lou and I wrote, but Moore is really the first person to make, as far as we know, an argument for an idea of free speech. Was kind of instrumental notion of free speech, that members of Parliament should be immune from any kind of prosecution for anything they say, so that they can advise the king, right, freely, without fear of any kind of retaliation. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a fascinating point. And that's a very classical notion too, the idea of right substantial counsel.
You know, my old boss, Dana Gioia, he told me once that when he was working here in New York in his company, each year they'd have an end of the year meeting and review how things went during the year. And Dana said, you know, they would start talking about all the great things that they did. He said, I don't want to know about that. What did we do wrong?
Yeah.
I want to hear much more what we did wrong, not what we did right. But you've got to create the conditions for people to be honest about that, especially when you have a hierarchical situation.
Right.
So, yeah. Now, Moore believes that he's got the church behind him and he has the clergy, but then comes the submission, quote, the submission of the clergy. What was the submission of the clergy?
That's a crucial point in this story for Moore. The submission of the clergy is the, let's say, last of several pieces of legislation which were shrinking the jurisdiction of the universal church, that would be the church that will be ultimately governed from Rome, the shrinking that jurisdiction in England. So what the submission of the clergy did was say that, all right, every action, judicial, legislative action by the hierarchy in England would be reviewed by the king. And so what that did was to create an autonomous church, broken off then from the universal church. And in Moore's own conception, the universal church, the universality of the church, was guaranteed by the, let's say, original and universal jurisdiction of the Holy See in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So with the submission of the clergy, and there's some antecedents too, which kind of took away some of that sort of discretion of the universal church in England, but this was total and complete. You no longer had a church which was in union with Rome. Also, as a practical matter, the appeal of the annulment proceedings, it's kind of a misnomer to call it a divorce, the appeal of the annulment proceedings were having been transferred to Rome, then became meaningless because the English hierarchy was autonomous and under the king.
And
so that Henry could say then, hey, Rome, where this proceedings were continuing under the influence of the Holy Roman Empire, you know, Charles, who was happened to be the nephew of Catherine, didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the matter would be final there in England. Of course, the result would be kind of a foregone conclusion.
And this is where Moore clearly starts realizing that I may be out on a limb here all by myself, more or less out of his house. Although, well, he was finally arrested. For what specific reason?
Well, I mean, out on a limb, I think Moore was realized, I think, from the very moment from 1529 when Henry starts poking around and getting opinions about whether or not he's married. I think that, you know, Moore already realizes he's out on a limb. You know, it's just, will the limb hold, or how far out is he?
Yeah.
At this juncture, of course, he's at the end of that limb, or it's gonna fall. So I think he was always in a very dangerous, precarious situation, and realized it continuously, but made a balance and saw that he could still do some good and maybe even turn the situation around, to quote the famous Father Newhouse, we're going to turn this around and maybe get Henry to call this whole thing off and, get back on board with his marriage and so forth. No, but that, of course, is not what happened, right?
The next step is the oath,
yeah,
correct?
Right. So I think that why he has to resign is that he can no longer work for the crown without cooperating in evil. Mm-hmm. The moral theologians say, amalum in se, something, an evil in itself. It's no longer just a question of kind of, let's say, material cooperation. It's a question of formal cooperation, because now there's just no chance for anything to be turned around. And so he sees no more room within which to maneuver. So that's why he has to step down. He went pretty far. I think we point out in the book, he went pretty far in order to stay in power and have that
right.
influence.
Right.
I think the kind of, well, how far he went was that he actually read to Parliament their opinions, the diverse opinions of many, scholars all over Europe that were positive for Henry's annulment.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Moore, it didn't agree with that, but he actually read that.
Well, so if Moore resigns, mm-hmm. he's willing to walk away, why not just let him go?
Well, they
why did.
Did
he end up arrested?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did let him go, and he lives in peace for almost 2 years, right? But what the what Parliament decided to do, well, what Cromwell decided to do, was in order to get all the clergy, especially the hierarchy, and the nobles on board, is to make an act of succession, which said that if, of course, this all occurred after Henry got his annulment and was married to Anne Boleyn. And by the way, I think I point out in the book that More, at great peril, didn't go to that wedding.
Right.
Even though his friends got together and sent him a new, sent him clothes to go, and which is kind of an interesting point. I mean, again, which is a, you know, comes up a lot today. I mean, you know, should I go to this wedding? This is my friend, right? More took a very hard line.
If you go, you're blessing it.
Yeah, if you go, you're blessing it.
If you attend,
it. Yeah.
then there it is.
Yeah, so More didn't go to that wedding. So Cromwell comes up with this brilliant idea, which is to consolidate this power, is to get everybody to recognize that the heirs, or the children, the progeny of Anne Boleyn and Henry would be the rightful heirs. And then everyone have, and then he also came up with an oath. And what happened was More was the only layman called in the, sort of say, the first roundup to make that oath. He was called with all of a bunch of, along with all these bishops. And he recounts this in a letter from the Tower to his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't know the exact contents of that first oath because it was only later on that Parliament, perhaps responding to More's own arguments, decided to make it a formal oath and to write it into the law so that everyone knew what it said. But it was clear, it's clear that the oath went beyond saying that any kids that Henry and Anne Boleyn have would be the rightful heirs. Because More, in his letter to Margaret, repeatedly mentions, I'm ready to recognize, right, whatever, whoever the Parliament wants to say is the heir, which is kind of an interesting fact. I mean, it's not a, you know, it just shows you the kind of discernment what More was engaging in. Because I don't think he, I'm confident that he didn't think it was a just, particularly just outcome that Catherine should be, you know, thrown over, and he didn't want that. But I think he also thought it wasn't a malum in se. In other words, a Parliament had discretion, however unwisely they might use their discretion, they had the discretion to decide, all right, these people are the rightful heirs. And More was ready for that. He couldn't take the oath because clearly the oath required him to say that the first marriage was bad.
Okay.
Yeah. Or that it wasn't a real marriage, it was rightfully annulled. And it also seemed to say that all of these acts which attend the annulment or divorce, that they were all rightfully done. And he wasn't ready to do that. So clearly it went beyond succession. And More offered to, hey, I'll take an oath to the succession, no problem, but I'm not taking this oath.
Okay.
And that's
that was
what got him arrested.
Done. That You're was arrested. Done. Right. And only one other bishop in the entire country.
Unbelievably so. One
refused.
Other bishop, John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester. Yeah.
Who
the only
who
one.
Ends up, you note, he's executed a few weeks before
ten
Moore's
days,
trial.
10 days before Moore's execution, he is executed, and roughly in a couple weeks before is also tried before Moore.
And Moore's the first.
But beautifully, Moore says at some point in his letter to Margaret, he says, even if Rochester, Margaret's his sister, his daughter, even if Rochester, referring to Bishop Fisher, even if Rochester changes his mind, with God's grace, I won't change my mind.
Right, right.
He got a hand to the guy. You know, he's really thinking about everything.
And the first threat of punishment was going to be life in prison.
Yeah,
not capital, because he wasn't charged with high treason.
Right. To refuse the oath, when they passed it, it was only a misprison of treason, and that only carries life in jail and confiscation of all your goods. So, yeah. They didn't have the goods on him to execute him.
But he sees what's happened to Rochester.
Rochester is prosecuted, is arrested and prosecuted in a completely parallel manner to More. So Fisher is Rochester. Fisher is also arrested for refusing the oath. While he's in prison, they pass the Treasons Act, which follows on the Act of Supremacy, and both More and Fisher are prosecuted under that Treasons Act. They gather evidence against them while they're in prison.
Okay.
So that's how that works. But More clearly, we know from his letters, before the Treasons Act was passed, he saw that they were going on, that this was going on to the next another level.
Capital.
Yeah, capital. They were going to find it. They were going to make it high treason, to deprive the king of his title. He saw that right from the beginning, and perhaps he knew that they tried, they wanted, the Cromwell wanted to do that, but couldn't get it through Parliament from the beginning. But he saw it coming.
Did Henry, you said earlier, you thought Henry could change More's mind. At this point, did he think, put him in prison, interrogate him, argue with him, threaten to raise the level to capital, he'll change his mind?
I think so. I think it's without a doubt that that Henry was attempting to change. Why wouldn't he? You know, in fact, we know that they sent people to try to change his mind. I mean, we have, and fortunately, Moore wrote all these letters, which were, you know, snuck out of jail, and we have them today. But he recounts the exchanges that he had with Lord Audley, who succeeded Moore as Chancellor of England. We have his Moore's account of his exchanges with Cromwell, right? We have his account of his exchanges with Norfolk, and most important, his exchanges with and numerous exchanges in letter and in person with his daughter Margaret, who was also given information from Audley, from Cromwell.
And she tried to convince him, come on.
Absolutely.
Just get with the program.
Yeah.
So you're quibbling here, and yes, we're going to lose you.
Right.
I'm not,
it's hard to say, well, you know, because it's Moore and Margaret, his daughter, had such a profound relationship, and they were in so many ways on the same page. It's not clear, you know, if Margaret is kind of a character in a kind of a play that Moore is presenting in order to convey a deeper truth about his own situation to others and also to posterity. But I asked this to Jerry Wegemer, who is, you know, a great friend and mentor, and, you know, one of the most knowledgeable people about Thomas Moore living, you know, on Earth right now. And he thinks that Margaret wanted him to change his mind.
Yeah.
Because Margaret herself did take the oath with a reservation. Because eventually
she had to take the oath.
Eventually they got to a lot of other people, and she did take the oath with the reservation.
Huh.
And Moore wasn't good. Moore didn't do that.
Well, you know, your final section, almost the final section, it goes into what sustained Moore through all of the imprisonment and the prospect of his own death and the prospect of losing everything for his family, called Joy in Suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was really Christ's example in the garden,
mm-hmm,
and in the Passion that gave him the courage and to go to his fate, feeling some degree of rejoicing in what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very powerful. I think it's a kind of a testament to just the kind of world-class character of Moore. I mean, kind of once in a century kind of person whose intellectual life is so perfectly integrated into his spiritual life, that when he's in prison, he writes these very erudite works of literature, you know, sort of exploring suffering and Christian suffering. The first one is this, you know, fairly complex work, which is but very rewarding, worth reading, called The Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation. And the second work, which is shorter, written with Cole, you know, because they had taken away his writing instruments, but a little bit more direct, but still a work of you know, literature, is The Sadness of Christ.
You quote from that where you say he found strength in the example of Christ above all by meditation on his Passion, and here's more. Is it not then a stupendous shame for us to forsake our Savior out of dread of temporal death, when he willingly suffered such a painful death rather than forsake us?
Right.
For him to go along with the king would be to betray what Jesus underwent. in those days.
Yeah, and Akas, the only thing I'd add to that quotation is that what makes this meditation peculiar and even more valuable is that, well, what you just read is, I think, is a fairly common, true and beautiful, compelling insight, but more, he had a special take on it, and his book meditates on just our Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane, from the point of after they leave the upper room to his arrest. So it's a kind of peculiar sort of segment of the Passion. And what Moore focuses on, among other things, is our Lord's agony in the garden. And and his sweating blood and his and then he notes how through this prayer, this agony, Jesus emerges with strength, you know, and is able to then face the soldiers who are arresting him, and then undergo his Passion, and so Moore draws the lesson that he's reluctant, Moore, to undergo this Passion, his own Passion, but he knows that he can, because our Lord himself sets the example of being overwhelmed and yet not conquered.
Right.
And so that's the great kind of contribution of Moore to that meditation.
You quote a few phrases here where Moore speaks. Whoever is utterly crushed by feelings of anxiety and tortured by the fear that he may yield to despair, you say, consider this agony of Christ. Meditate on it constantly. And that meditation is what allows Moore to walk up to the scaffold and with a smile and joke.
Yeah.
He even makes a joke to his executioner, correct?
That's right. He says, help me up the stairs, but as for, you know, coming down, I can shift for myself.
that's right. Now, let me finish with a long quotation that you insert here. Were these the words that Moore spoke from the scaffold, like the blessed Apostle St. Paul?
No, that was after the verdict.
That was after the verdict. Here's what he says. The people who sentenced him, like the blessed Apostle St. Paul, was present and consented to the death of St. Stephen and kept their clothes that stoned him to death, and yet be they now both twain holy saints in heaven and shall continue their friends forever, Stephen and Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So I verily trust and shall therefore right heartily pray that though your lordships have now here in earth been judges to my condemnation, we may yet hereafter in heaven merrily all meet together to our everlasting salvation.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder how those judges felt, realizing we have just sentenced someone who is far, far beyond us in so many ways.
Yeah.
That's why we keep reading more.
I think so.
That's why we remember his example.
I think so. And, you know, and also Lou and I love that quotation, because it's quintessential Moore. It's got multiple, you know, meanings, and all of them are true. You know, I mean, it's not being ironic.
It doesn't leave the judges off the hook.
That's right.
Either.
It doesn't. But at the same time, it makes the point about, all right, I may be wrong, or you may be acting in good conscience, and we'll all be together, united. But, you know, but the parting shot is also it's double edged. You know,
yeah.
And Moore is able to do that over and over again. I mean, his use of humor, Lou and I have written about his use of humor in Dialogue of Comfort as well as Sadness. I mean, it's a very, very powerful tool. And of course, that's very much in line with classical antiquity, the importance of humor. But, you know, Moore brought it to real new heights. I mean, he really thought it was important to be able to laugh. Laughing was very instructive.
I believe you put at one point that what a leader must be able to do is to look at himself every once in a while and laugh.
Absolutely.
You must have a little bit of irony about yourself. When you lose that, then we're all in trouble.
Yeah. So it's a fascinating point about Moore, is that it kind of goes, it kind of connects with something we talked earlier about Moore's relationship to the world, why he went into the king's service. I mean, you know, he has this, as we called it, qualified embrace of the world. I mean, he doesn't want to abandon the world, but at the same time, he recognizes kind of its sort of like ultimate, you know, unreality. It's very Augustinian that way. You know, Augustine was very concerned about the tranquillitas ordinis, and Moore is too, and he doesn't want to abandon the world. In fact, he's steeped in, you know, classical authors who put great worth in engagement with the world, and yet he's truly a Christian humanist, right? Who sees, well, there are limits, you know, there are limits, and you know, if you reach the limit, I mean, you can get in real trouble, and you know, Moore reached that limit, so. He's just a very powerful example, you know, even today, of someone who engages with the world and is able to integrate his love of God, his faith, with this, let's say, full embrace of the world, and yet has the wherewithal, the spiritual resources to make those decisions, you know, where he can no longer, as it were, cooperate and be able to extract himself and pay whatever price. Amazing.
David Oakley, thank you.
Oh, this has been a pleasure. Thank you.